Welcome to the Development Locker podcast, the podcast designed specifically for aspiring academy football players and their development. I'm your host, Lee Wood, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey. Whether you're a young talent dreaming of making it to the top, a dedicated coach looking for expert insights, or a parent seeking information into how to guide your son along their journey, this podcast is your ultimate resource for everything related to academy football. Each episode will bring you exclusive interviews with renowned coaches, former academy players who have successfully made the transition to professional football, and industry experts who will share their invaluable knowledge and tips to help you excel on and off the pitch. Over the next 48 episodes, we'll be diving deep into the mental and physical conditioning, the various aspects of player development, nutrition, injury prevention, and maintaining a balanced lifestyle to ensure you reach your full potential. We'll also discuss what to do when your dreams come to an end, whenever that may be, along the journey, with insight from those who have gone through this part of the journey and come out the other side a better person. Also, we'll be joined by those who support people like you when, and not if, that day comes when football isn't the only dream you want to pursue. But it's not just about the technicalities of the game. We'll also explore the mindset and mentality required to thrive in a competitive world of academy football. We'll discuss the importance of resilience, self-belief, and effective goal setting to help you overcome challenges and achieve your dreams. So, whether you're looking for guidance on improving your technical abilities, seeking advice on navigating the trials and tribulations of the academy system, or simply want to stay motivated and inspired, we're here to support you every step of the way. Get ready to learn, grow, and be inspired by the stories of those who have walked the same path you're on right now. Together, we'll unlock the secrets to success and help you gain that crucial edge in your academy journey, as well as prepare you for that alternative pathway. So, grab your boots, put on your headphones, and get ready to take your game to the next level. This is your podcast, and I'm thrilled to have you join us as we bring you your interview from the locker. Stay tuned for our weekly episodes, which we'll bring you every Monday morning, and we look forward to you joining us then. Welcome to the Development Locker podcast. In this week's episode, we take you on a journey of self-discovery, growth, and finding true happiness in the art of well-being, exploring powerful techniques to reframe our mindset, master crisis management, and build meaningful, effective relationships. In this fast-paced world we live in, where stress and uncertainty often loom over us, it's crucial to equip ourselves with the tools necessary to navigate life's challenges and nurture our own well-being. Today, we're uncovering the secrets to cultivating a resilient mindset, embracing change, and transforming setbacks into opportunities for growth. Joining us today, Brad Fullerton, who is a well-being coach with a sports psychology background, dedicated to helping others thrive in the face of adversity, whether that be in tennis, academy football, or in education. Brad is a pioneer in supporting individuals in reframing techniques. He will guide us through the process of shifting our perspective, enabling us to find strength and positivity, even in the most trying of circumstances. A crisis management expert with years of experience in guiding individuals through challenging times, Brad will share invaluable insights on how to remain calm and composed when faced with these crises, teaching us the art of resilience and providing practical strategies to overcome any obstacle that life throws our way. Lastly, this week's guest has helped countless individuals foster meaningful connections in both personal and professional spheres, who will reveal the essential ingredients for building effective relationships, offering guidance on communication, empathy, and fostering mutual understanding. Together, we'll embark on a journey of self-discovery and empowerment, unveiling the transformative power of reframing, crisis management, and building those effective relationships. So get ready to unlock your true potential and live a life filled with joy, purpose, and fulfillment. So put 60 minutes aside and invest in your well-being as we're about to explore the emerging discipline within academy football. Be prepared to learn some of the coping strategies when times get tough, how to flip your perspective in life and in your performances, as well as what to do in order to focus on you, as we bring you this and much, much more in this week's interview from the locker. Welcome everyone to another episode of the podcast, and we're very fortunate to have Brad on. And Brad, we get right into the questions on this podcast, and we always start with the why. And I suppose this is probably going to be the most difficult question of all. Why is psychology still having to fight for prominence or kind of parity within academy football, in your opinion? Why are people still questioning it? Why is it not fully embedded right throughout the academy system in this country?
Yeah, I think it's a question that runs through my mind often, having worked in the academy setup over the last year. And I think there's a few answers to it. I would say that sports psychology is, out of the sports sciences, I would say one of the most emerging sort of disciplines, and one of the ones that's most sort of new to the field. So therefore, I think that places it, whether for right or wrong reason, it's slightly at the bottom of the pile. You've had other sort of forms of support that have been embedded into academy football for years now, like your S&C and your sports science as well. And I think with those areas, particularly sports science, you've got your running metrics, etc. And for S&C, you can see whether someone's improved in the gym. So success is more black and white. I think with in a sport like football, and where the demands are so high, there's so much pressure for success. Well, psychology, success is more subjective. I think there is a bit of resistance around that because it's unclear whether something is working, particularly in Scottish football. I think at the moment, where there is this lack of sort of funds available. And I think that means, are we willing to invest so much into something when we're not totally 100% sure of how much of an impact it's been having? And that's from more the performance side of things. I mean, I've been working on a wellbeing programme the last season called the Young Player Wellbeing Academy. And we've been working with local clubs in Scotland, and we are external to the clubs. So we're not actually, you know, I've not been working for the clubs. I've been working for the charity that's created this. So it's almost as if it's a bit on the side at points. Although I think there are strengths to that. If you're external, players are more likely to open up on sort of wellbeing related issues because they feel like it's not going to affect game time. You know, maybe coaches aren't going to find out because they think it's going to, you know, affect their chances of making it to the next level, etc. So I think there's a few reasons in there, but the ultimate problem really for me is the stigma around psychology, and players shouldn't have to worry about whether they tell their manager, oh, I'm not feeling so good like emotionally today, or I've had a really long day and I think it's just dragging me down a little bit. Players shouldn't be afraid to open up on things like that to anyone inside the club. And I think that they are, because there still is a bit of a stigma in football that there's something wrong with him. He's going to be rubbish today if I play him on a Saturday. Therefore, he's just going to get benched. And that's only going to make the matter worse.
Where do you think the crossover is in that then, in terms of, you can tell us a little bit more about your wellbeing academy in a minute, but I totally agree from your perspective to be not associated with that club or with that academy gives them that freedom. They can be more open, more honest, more transparent with you. But where's the crossover then between maybe having that relationship with the club psychologist or player care or welfare or any member of staff within Academy Football? Where's the crossover between having that real, authentic, natural, long-lasting relationship with a player who's been in the pre-academy, come up through the age groups into the 13s, 14s, years and years and years of building that relationship, to where they feel that they have to go external? Is there a crossover, or is it purely based on the individual?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as always, it does depend on the individual. I mean, I know, like, in some elite sportsmen, they prefer to have their psychologist separate to the club, but ultimately the club at all times, for me, still has a duty of care to look after their players. So there has got to be some form of internal support. Whether players want to seek external support or not, I think should be up to them. And also, it shouldn't be, you know, a score against their name in a negative kind of sense if they do want to seek that, because ultimately, if it's going to improve their well-being, improve their performance, and then they're going to take that back into the club that they play for, and then that's going to help the team, it's going to help the club, I don't think that should be an issue. Although, as I mentioned, I feel like the consistency of sports psych well-being support in football should be more prevalent. You know, that should be something that is essential for all clubs, I think, so that the player can work with individuals within the club who can collaborate together, who all have the player's best interests at heart. So it's all sort of in-house and you're all driving towards the same thing. So there are those sort of, as having an external person, you know, are they going to be able to communicate with the clubs as well as someone they would be in-house? I don't know, but at the same time, having an external source might be better for the player because it can help to reduce pressure and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, I know it's a hard question to answer that one, because it's kind of doing a bit of a battle, like, on from a, you know, the academy system perspective, you're kind of operating outside that kind of. So tell us a little bit more about the Young Player Wellbeing Academy, what it is, what it does, and how it, apologies in advance if I'm using the incorrect terminology, but filling those gaps that aren't there. You mentioned that clubs and academy should have a duty of care, but obviously you've set this academy up because you've recognised there's not really enough support there, or there's a need for it to be external. So tell us a bit about your Young Player Wellbeing Academy, what it is, what it does, and how it complements what academies are currently doing, and best interest of the player, I suppose, is at the kind of the crux and the centre of it, is it?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It's very holistic, as I think the modern kind of era in sport, especially in football, is becoming. It's about the person and the footballer, or the athlete, whatever you might want to call that. So that was the sort of the main premise of our programme. And on the programme, I'm a wellbeing coach along with three of my colleagues, and we have a co-creator and creator of the programme. And essentially what we aim to do was to empower young players, young academy players, to have more control over their well-being. So initially it's more of a remote-based programme. It's done through Instagram, where players will be allocated a well-being coach. So for example, I have around 20 to 25 players who I communicate with through Instagram every week, and it's about well-being check-ins. But at the same time, we have an Instagram account that's running sort of content. So for example, week one we might focus on confidence, next week we might talk about leadership, next week we might talk about physical well-being. So there's education around different elements of each of those topics, and then that sort of trickles down to the well-being check-ins on the kind of the direct messaging service. So, you know, okay mate, have you ever thought about confidence, or is this something that you've given much thought to in your game, or did you know about that? Let's have a little conversation about that. Maybe we'll do some small goal setting sessions. But I think ultimately, for me, the main takeaway I've got from the programme is that it's offering coping strategies for transitions, because it's something that is massive in academy football, Lee, as you know. So there's different points in the year where maybe we'll start to focus on more transitional support. So talking about things like identity, you know, maybe resilience or exploring other hobbies, etc. All in the hope that when these transitions come, successful or not, our players feel like they have the appropriate tools to navigate it successfully. And we provide additional information through, we've got our own podcast as well. And we also
do, go on, name drop it while you can.
It's called the Young Player Wellbeing Podcast. Well, not as fine-tuned as you. I know she had a nice wee mic set up and stuff like that. So we're getting there. We're getting there. So that just allows the players to, you know, have, it allows us to provide more in-depth information than we can on like an Instagram post and chat and use our own reflections on it as well. And it's a medium that's probably a little bit more interesting. As well as that, we go into the clubs every 6 weeks and deliver workshops, which is all led by the players. So what do you guys want to know more about? Or did it not make sense in the sort of Instagram post we've been doing? Okay, let's go and do a workshop on that. And the coaches are sort of involved throughout it as well. So it's a very player-led program, well-being orientated, but ultimately it's about, you know, this is how well-being can affect your performance, and sort of provide an education on around that.
Superb. I mean, my next question was going to be, and you might change your answer here, I don't know, how do you get players and staff on side? I mean, you talked about coaches then buying into it and it being player-led. Do you feel that because you're external, that's how you're getting players to fully engage and see the value in that well-being work? Or are there things that academy staff could be doing to get a better engagement for players? What's your thoughts on that? Is it you feel you get a better engagement because you're external, you've not got the club badge on? And is there anything that we from the academy system can take from your approach of getting a better engagement from our players?
I think the external approach has pros and cons. I mean, what I like about it is that it's not compulsory. So the players, can you can sign up to it if you want to be involved in the programme, if you feel you're going to benefit from having a wellbeing coach. And the content that we put out, well, you can engage with that if you like. I mean, it's up to you. We feel it's going to help you and that's, we're here to support you. So engage in it. So, I mean, there's always a sort of rule around these things that, you know, a third of the people are going to engage. You're going to get a third who are sort of convinced. And then you're going to get a third who just aren't really interested in that type of support, which is totally fine. But I think giving the option is the important thing. And what we've kind of, well, I've really prided myself on working on the programme is my ability to build effective relationships with the players. And that's noticed when you see them in person. I mean, something as simple as like a fist bump or a how we doing or any small conversations when you see them in person really kind of makes you feel like you've had an impact. And I know that might sound daft for people listening from the outside, but stuff like that is really important, and it makes you feel like you've done something right for them to be engaging with you like that. I think in terms of the staff support, I did feel like there was a bit of resistance at the start, which I can understand. Who are these guys that are coming in from outside and they're trying to tell us about well-being? Wait, now, like, I'm the coach and I'm in charge of these boys. Whether it was as full on as that, I don't know, but that's the sort of thoughts that you have. But once you get in, you make your face known around the club a little bit more, you make an impact with the players, then the coaches start to sort of warm up to you a little bit and they go, okay, like, you're just trying to support the guys the same way that we are. We're not trying to step in any toes. We're just trying to help them go in the right direction, which I think everyone in the club is doing as well. I mean, we all want them to be successful, right?
Yeah, true. And I think coaches are very integral in that. I think the players, you know, across the board, regardless of, you know, what country you're in, what category status you're at, well, you know, probably even whether it's grassroots academy football or not, they do look up to the coaches, don't they? And they do look for a little bit of kind of reaffirming of, oh, is this okay? And if the coaches are present, if the coaches are buying in, it's, you know, it's a win-win. You're going to get more than a third of your players engaged in that. You talked about there from academy perspective, and not sure of how much input you've had with young professionals or academy players who turn pro or in the professional game, do you see a shift in approach or a shift in the view of psychology from academy to professional football? Is it a case of where it's a little bit dog eat dog within the academy system, so people don't want to reach out for psychology because it'd be seen as a weakness, whereas as a pro, if they're visiting, seeing, open about psychology and interested and curious about it, it's like, oh yeah, that's what's setting him apart. He's a really good pro because he's wanting to continue to develop as a person as well as a player. Do you see there's a massive difference between the two, or are things changing in your opinion?
Yeah, well, I think, as I mentioned before, the holistic approach, the person and the athlete, is becoming more kind of prevalent. You hear people referencing stuff like that a lot more. Identities began to be explored a lot more. Like you said, exploring the sort of the person behind the athlete, I think, is becoming a lot more important, especially in the elite level. I can't comment too much in the professional game. I've not worked in that space yet myself, hopefully one day. But I think with the more elite that you get, there's of course more funding available, and then there becomes, what else can we do to get a cutting edge in this? And I think psychology support at that point becomes extremely kind of, you know, it's vital in terms of performance. I mean, you look at the likes of Arteta and Southgate, who have very clearly embedded psychology support into their management style. And you can see the way that that almost trickles down into the players. And the likes of Gareth Ainsworth and Richard Dobson, who did some amazing work at Wickham, they're now at QPR. It clearly trickles down into the players in that way. I'd say that in interviews, etc., you don't hear professional players reference sports psychology as much in other sports. And I don't know if that's to do with that. Is there still a stigma around it? I mean, we spoke to David Wheeler on our podcast about, and he's got an article on the BBC about hypermasculinity in sport and, you know, the dressing rooms that he's worked in and how negative it can be for well-being, mental health, and for performance as well. So there are advocates out there for it in the elite game. Could there be a little bit more in football? Yeah, I think so. But you do have to question whether that stigma is the reason for, you know, maybe the lack of them.
Yeah, I'd still, my level of involvement in the professional game is minimal as well, but I think there's still that stigma in football if you compare it to other sports. You know, thinking like Johnny Wilkinson, how many years has he worked with a psychologist, golfers, Formula One drivers? And that brings me nicely onto your next question of tennis. So you've got a background in tennis. Do you see every other sport but football embracing it and not necessarily showcasing it because it is just natural? It's natural for a tennis player to see a psychologist in the most natural setting. It's not got to be a formal thing of, oh, I'm losing a few games, I need to see a psychologist because there's something wrong with my, you know, decision-making process or whatever it may be. It's just natural. It's operating always in the background. So there's not that thing to name drop in interviews. Do you see, what's your experience of tennis? Do they fully embrace? Is there still a bit of a stigma? Is there a bit of a barrier, a bit of a challenge around psychology in tennis? Do we look at other sports kind of through rose-tinted glasses in terms of their approach to psychology?
Well, you know, I came up, I mean, I still play football. It was my sport from a young age. And it's when I went to uni and when, you know, even at the start of my training, it was, oh, I want to work in football. And then, you know, I contacted an organisation in Scotland to, you know, just to see if they wanted some psychology support. And they were thankfully very accepting of it. Now, when I go into this, I'm thinking, oh no, I don't know that much about tennis. You know, I know the basics, I don't know the demands, but it was so welcoming when you speak to the coaches and they're so, like, they're already versed on sports psychology. You can tell the way that, with their language, you know, the way that they coach, that it's something that is clearly been sort of drilled into them from, you know, young ages of playing tennis. So I think, like you say, it is the culture in that sport, that sports psychology is something that, that we engage with, right? And it's not, like you mentioned, crisis management. It's not, oh my God, look, I've just lost a few games in a row. Right, go into the office and sit down with a sports psych for an hour and quote unquote sort your head out. It's what types of things can we be doing during a match that is all going to be sports psychology based? So whether that's how do we use between the points, how do we use our routines? It's all about sort of resilience. You know, you're constantly dealing in tennis with, you're either going to win this point, right, or you're going to lose it. So you're having to deal with that constantly. The decision making in tennis is insane how quickly it goes. You know, there's the ball's getting fired back to you, say 100 odd mile an hour, and you're going to have to decide. You've got a million technical things to decide what you could do all at once. So that's another element of it. A lot of my work has been done with the 14 and under athletes in that space, where you're educating them on this is what sports psychology is, and this is how it can really help you. We do a lot of stuff on, we did goal setting, we've done some values work, and more recently going into a busy tournament period, we've done like reframing, because there's a lot of performance anxiety around tennis, you know. Oh no, I've got the second seed in the first round. That means that everyone else here thinks that I'm going to get hammered. Oh, how can we flip it? How can we flip that? Yeah, you might be playing the second seed, but what can you do within your game that can take it to them? What can you get out of this experience that's going to benefit you and not hold you back? So it's a lot about, you know, reframing the initial thought in the hope that it generates more positive feelings, which in turn should generate more positive behaviour. That's what I'm going for, Lee, anyway. I'm doing my best with that, mate, I must say. It's hard work sometimes in the youth sport. Emotions are running high, but I think we're beginning to chip away.
Yeah, I mean, you're going through some of the things there and the key components and characteristics of the sport. And yeah, there probably couldn't be more poles apart, could they, in terms of that, like you said, you know, in football, you know, you're lucky if you get 2-3 goals a game. You know, there's the odd game where there's, you know, goal fest, 4-5, mm-hmm. 6, maybe 8 goals during that game. But tennis, it's every point's to be hit for, and you know, the amount that a player in a team sport will actually touch, having contact with the ball, yeah, it doesn't even compare to tennis. Like you said, it's over and over, and you've got very minimal, you know, you've not got a chance to recover. It's coming back over the net time and time again, isn't it? So the pressures they're under is immense. Maybe that then brings on why they want to embrace it, because they realise the massive importance. There's no hiding place. It's an individual sport unless you're playing in doubles. But yeah, even then, the numbers are not stats in your favour, are you? In terms of you've been involved in tennis, and you know, you're starting up your wellbeing academy and doing the podcast, I want to ask a question that I think quite a lot of our listeners will get a lot from. So we're at this time of the season now where, you know, retain and release has been done. The end of last season, it's pre-season, early days of the season, and some people listening to this will be without a club, maybe got a trial, maybe got a loan, maybe training with a club or an academy just to, you know, tick over, maintain the fitness. Or it could be potentially worst case scenario, that phone's not ringing, they've got no real idea of what they're going to do, when they're going to do it. It's the first time they've not had structure in their life to be able to get up, get into training, you know, have banter with the lads in the changing room, kick a few balls, do a bit of running, the whole rigmarole and the whole kind of schedule that we put our players through in the academy system. What I want to link that to you and you being ultimately kind of self-employed and not on the payroll of a club or just one job role in your life. How do you psychologically prepare for that and deal with being in between clients, being in those parts of your career of being ultra busy and then not busy at all? How do you psychologically prepare for that, and how do you deal with that when you're going through it? Thinking of some of our listeners who are kind of in a similar situation can take some kind of hints, tips and tricks from you of how you prepare for it before it happens and how you deal with it when it's happening.
Yeah, I think That's a great question, and I like the connection from myself to the academy, you know, set up as well. Firstly, I understand the frustration that a lot of our academy players might be having. I've never played at that level myself, but I'm in a position where I feel like I've worked so hard and I've done so much, yet if I'm being honest, I don't feel like I am at where I thought I was going to be. Now, that's got to be the exact same for some of our players who might have just experienced being released from a club, or some players who, like you say, the phone's not ringing. So, yeah, of course, you've done loads and loads and loads to get up to this position that you're in now. And it's a strong position to be in, although you may not feel like it at the moment. You have picked up so many different skills along your journey. How can you now transfer those skills to other areas of your life? So if that means being busy by contacting loads of different people, exploring other parts of your identity where skills that you've learned in football could be even more useful, you know, what is it you want to do for a living? How can what you've learned be used to your advantage in your career moving forward? And don't do that alone. Use your support network. You know, I'm 26 now, but, you know, my mum's still getting a phone saying, you know, I feel like I've done this, I've done that, and it's just not working out. Do the same. Speak to your parents. I don't know if you've got mates that can help you through that. I certainly do. Or you still have those contacts at clubs, I would hope, who are still trying to look after you. Use those contacts that you've developed over this time and use them to help you moving forward. And I'd say lastly, and something that honestly I'm bad for as well sometimes, is comparing yourself to others. Oh, wait, now I started doing this at the same time as this person, but this person's now doing better, or quote unquote better, than what I'm doing. How is that? Oh, that's so unfair, blah, 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 blah. Avoid comparing yourself with others. Focus on what it is that you want to achieve and work towards that. Develop an action plan and work towards that, and use the people around you to support you on that journey as well.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing taken out of that is don't do it alone. And that's one of the bugbears from my role in player care. And that's why I was talking about the engagement that you get on in your Wellbeing Academy, and the people you work with, is that's one of the ones that keep you up at night, because you're wanting to help. And then you see some of the stories nationally, you know, across the board, of those players who've been released, and, you know, oh, well, you know, I didn't get this, and oh, I struggled with this, and mental health, well-being, you know, kind of really fell out of love with football. And it doesn't have to be that way. They don't have to do it on their own. Now, it doesn't mean you or I are, you know, the answers to all their problems. We're probably not even, you know, collectively. It should be multiple people, a network, like you've said. They've gained skills through their journey, and they'll have gained contacts within that same journey as well, whether it's their favourite coach at academy level, whether that's a psychologist within that academy, whether it's someone like you they're working with externally, whether it's the, you know, there's a multitude of people, parents, another one, you know, don't do it alone. I think if listeners only take one thing from this episode, which I'm sure they'll be taking many, is that don't do it alone. There's plenty of people within your network you might not know. And I think, you know, you saying there about setting yourself an action plan, I think within that action plan, one of the first tasks, you know, write down your contact list, your network, right? Who can I lean on for this? Right, I want to get fit. Can I go back to my academy and ask the strength and conditioning coach, is there a program I can follow to keep myself ticking over? If it's, you know, they've had contact with you every 6 weeks, you said about, you know, the Instagram page you've got, I'm sure you wouldn't mind, you know, one of your players reaching out and going, ah, struggling with this at the moment. Is there anything that, you know, can help me? And yeah, just don't do it alone.
Yeah.
In terms of moving on from that, and kind of, I think a lot of lads who do, inverted commas, make it in the academy system and turn professional, I think they sometimes get left alone, because there seem to be, that's the idea of success, isn't it? That we all go, oh, they've got a pro card, oh, well done. You know, those who got released, they're the ones who go through the mental health struggles, the well-being and all the rest of it. Firsthand, I see that's not always the case. It's still those lads who will get the professional contract, who will still maybe struggle to establish themselves in the 21s or the first team. they might get sent out on loan. It's still a challenging period for them. What kind of advice have you got for those lads now at this stage in the season who are entering that first team changing room for the very first time? So they've now gone from top dog in the 18s or 21s. Now they're kind of small fry within the first team environment. They've gone from playing regular every single minute of the pitch, first name on the team sheet, to I might not even be in the squad. If I am in the squad, I'm just travelling. If I am travelling, I'm probably not even going to get on. Or I'm on the bench, but I'm probably going to get 2 minutes here, 5 minutes here. What advice have you got for those in terms of their struggles psychologically and some of the effects that it will have on their well-being, because they're perceived to be successful and often forgotten about?
Yeah, I suppose it's big fish, small pond to small fish, big pond, really, isn't it? A transition, one of the probably most difficult ones, I would say. I think it's important to use the people like yourself, Lee, your player Kales, or anyone at the club to support you through that transition, or whether that's a well-being coach. What is it that's bothering you? And can we chat through that and try to sort of develop some solutions that are gonna work for you? I think another important characteristic that, you know, I've heard coaches and sports scientists at clubs identify for young players coming up is leadership. So is there something that you can do that's going to help you to become more of a leader? Can you draw upon some of the characteristics of the more senior players and sort of add those sort of strings to your bow, in a sense? So picking up skills from others. And I would also say that this is likely not the position that you're going to be in forever. The first year is going to be hard. Of course it is. But it's a slow journey. It's not one that you're just going to accelerate through the ranks. You know, not everyone's going to be that wonder kid that plays in the Premier League when they're 16. So it's about understanding that this process is normal and that it happens to a lot of academy players, but trying to get as much out of it as you can, because you never know, in a year, in 2 years, the time that you've spent collecting skills and developing other areas of yourself might be the difference. You know, you might be able to use them when you're into that starting 11 in a couple of years, whether that's at the club you're at now or another club, whether that's up or down levels as well. And also, you might be able to influence people who were in the similar position as you those 2 years ago. So pick up as much as you can from senior players during that time, and, you know, use the likes of yourself, Lee, to support you through that transition, because it's, you know, everyone at the club knows that that is a big one, and they'd be I'm sure they'd be ready to support you.
Yeah, it's important to mention there. Yeah, nothing does last forever, and it is a normal process, whatever normal is. But yeah, you're not alone. It happens to a lot of players who get that professional contract, sign the dotted line, and yeah, it's almost like the gold medal syndrome, isn't it? With Olympians, yeah. Of right, I've got to top of the mountain. Now what? It's like, oh, I've got that pro contract. Those outside think, you've got it made. You're on this. You're on that. You're getting paid for doing something you love. But the challenge just starts again, but in a slightly different way, really. Mm-hmm. There's very few guarantees in life or in academy football. I think, unfortunately, one guarantee is that academy players will get injured to some degree, whether that's a, you know, short-term injury that keeps them out for a training session or two, whether it's a few days, a few weeks, a little bit longer. From your experience, what do you see is the biggest effect on predominantly the well-being of those individuals, and what should be part of the rehabilitation process for the short, medium and long-term injuries that academy players will unfortunately suffer as part of their academy journey?
Yeah, well, firstly, I think the emotional support is crucial. You know, that empathy, developing trust and relationships with the players who have just experienced an injury, whether that's short, medium or long term, to sort of, you know, assist them through that stage, because I think feelings that I've encountered players experiencing are as if they've just went back to square one. You know, I'm never going to be able to get back to where I was. I may as well just pack it in, I don't know, a worst case. But maybe instead of going back to square one, you're maybe back at square, I don't know, five or six. So can you take something from that? I think it's important to engage in conversations with the physio. I mean, they're going to give you some amazing advice, but I read stuff around everyone at the club being the psychologist. You know, if you're injured, you're likely going to spend a lot of time with the physio, whether that's talking about your injury or talking about other stuff. Use them. I mean, as a psychologist, observing practice at academy football, I find that I spend the most time with the injured players because they're maybe at the side foam rolling or maybe doing some stretches up against the wall whilst the rest of the boys are on the pitch. So I think it's about trying to take something from your conversations with those guys, and that probably ties closer into the sort of informational support that you're going to get from physio, S&C, coaches, psychologists. So try and get something from it. I spoke earlier on the pod about reframing things. So is this the world's against me? I can't do anything. Oh, this is so unfair. Or is it, okay, I've maybe experienced a bit of a setback. Can you show resilience through developing some goals for yourself over that time? Can you stay motivated by saying, okay, today this is what I wanted to achieve related to my injury, or by the end of the week I want to be able to do this? So I think it's about, you know, in-house, it's the multidisciplinary team becomes so important because the information should be fed round in a bit of a circle. So whether that's the physio telling the psych that they've maybe been mentioning they've been struggling with this stuff, or whether that's yourself, Leo, at the player care, that can be fed round to coaches, and that can then be fed round to S&C to sort of develop, you know, an integrated plan that considers all elements for the player. I think that's something that's really important. And probably just lastly, around normalizing injury. I know that it's difficult. I wouldn't be saying that to a player as soon as I've done the injury, or, you know, injuries are normal, but understanding that this does happen to every player along their journey, it's the important thing is about how you respond to it that's going to say the most about you as a person and as a player, I think.
Yeah, that's good advice. And speaking of more advice, putting the focus on you now, some people listen to this, you know, we talk about transition, talk about, you know, career after football as well. Those who probably want to stay within football, but not in a performance element, want to be a psychologist or work with players in terms of their well-being and some of the great work that you do. What advice have you got for some of our listeners listening to you now and thinking, ah, yeah, you know, whether it's here and now, whether it's something in the future, whether they've got skills they want to transfer and, like you said, show empathy and kind of, you know, if they've got that lived experience as academy player, could they go full circle and start to support the next generation of academy players? Any advice for them to enter the world of psychology and working with athletes around their well-being? Any lessons that you've learned along the way or you're currently learning now that you want to pass on to some of our listeners thinking about pursuing a career in psychology?
Yeah, I'd say do your research before going into it. I mean, it's a long process. I mean, you do your fifth year at uni and then you still have 2 years of training to do before you're even accredited. And then even at that, there's not as many jobs as you'd think. So do your research into that before you start, because it can be a bit of a slog. But as I mentioned to you, Lee, the reason that I went into this was because, you know, I feel like I have a passion for helping other people. I explored that at the start in coaching, and then thought, coaching's not really for me, but this more psychological side interested me a little bit. So that's why I went into it. And in 20 years, I feel like that I'm going to be satisfied with the career path that I've chosen. So I think it's just about evaluating what's important to you. If you want to make thousands and thousands and millions of pounds, then maybe going into some form of, I don't know, engineering or something like that might be better for you. But for me, as someone who's always loved sport, I'm going to feel, you know, happy in my life in 10, 15 years and know that I've made an impact on other young athletes who are maybe in a similar position to myself. And for me, that's extremely rewarding.
Good. And then in terms of that career pathway, we both know that, you know, whether it's as an intern, as a placement student, there's almost that expectation to do things for free or very little kind of financial return, should we say. You know, I've seen it from my perspective. You know, we've at the club I work at, you know, we've kind of profited, been very fortunate in some of the placement students we've had and interns and links with, you know, universities to get a really good psychology program up and running. In terms of from your side as a psychologist, I'm pretty sure you can probably spend another hour telling us the stories of all the things that you've had to do that probably might not be psychology related, but to pay your dues, to get your foot in the door, to work your way up. Give some of our listeners thinking then of pursuing that career, you know, kind of like the willingness to do something for free. Is that something that you don't see in modern society? Is it something now that, you know, you're saying about, you know, the kind of money people potentially, you know, should be looking at other careers if it's for, you know, a financial gain in terms of a career? Do you feel that the modern graduate from universities, whether it's undergrad, postgraduate, they're unwilling to do things for free? Or do you still see a lot of hardworking, grafting individuals who are willing to go above and beyond for very little kind of, yeah, return on their time and their effort? What do you see? What's the current landscape within? And set the scene for those people who are thinking about going to psychology, how hard it is and the things you have to do for free just to get your foot in the door.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly know a lot of fellow kind of trainee psychologists that have had to start at the bottom. I mean, just like you mentioned, doing daft jobs just to get a foot in the door. But I think that it's so important to network. So it's so important to get your face out of there in sports psychology. And if that means at the start doing some stuff for free, which isn't exactly in the most glamorous environment you might have thought, you know, it's because it's not all suns and sun and rainbows. You might have to do that, and that's okay. But just know that the groundwork that you're putting in will have a positive impact moving forward. For example, you might go in, you're doing work for free, you're not getting any expenses. Then a time might come where you now are getting expenses. Then moving down the line, things might change. You might start getting paid for it. Then things might change even more and you're full time. So extreme example of it, but it is all worth it. I think from as far as I know, unis are still encouraging students through placements and stuff like that to engage in placement modules. And one thing that I'd done when I was in my undergrad was when I went into my placement, I just continued it throughout the year. So you're only meant to do it for 3 months. So I just continued it throughout the year because the guy that I was working with, Dr. Michael Malone, was a doctor in sports psychology. So I was like, I may as well stay in with this guy. And, you know, ended up benefiting me. I still speak to Michael a lot. He's given me an amazing reference, which actually helped me to get into my master's program. So you never know, without sticking in a little bit more, I might not have been in this position just now. So I would say do it, stick at it, but know your value. And when you get to a certain point, don't be doing stuff for free. So I'm at that point at the moment where, you know, I'm not going to be going out on a limb and doing people a favour, particularly in football, where I feel like my experience is broad and vast enough that I can make a significant impact. But maybe if I'm looking to develop knowledge of, let's say, athletics, I might work with a track runner for free. Or if I really want to go and work in golf and I don't feel competent or confident enough to work in that space for a fee, maybe I'll try and reach out to work with a golfer for a block of sessions, and once I feel confident enough, then I'll maybe start charging. And that's the position I'm in as a trainee. That might shift when the accreditation comes through and things like that, and you're more recognised by governing bodies, etc. But yeah, I would say do it, because it's actually quite enjoyable getting out in the field and meeting people and networking, and it will only benefit you moving forward.
How hard is it to make that cut off to kind of go, right, enough's enough now, I've done X amount of sessions, I've done, you know, X amount of effort, now's the time, where is there a clear indication of when to make that decision and kind of when to stop to give things for free? Because that must be difficult, because you're doing something you love, you've formed a relationship with whatever organization, whether it's tennis, football, whatever it may be. How hard is it to kind of go, right, yeah, I'm gonna have to rein that in now and start charging you, because you're ultimately doing something you love, aren't you?
Yeah, you're doing something you love, of course, but I think in sport they can take you for a bit of a ride on that, and it can be manipulated a little bit. So I would say have conversations with people, and I mean, these conversations are horribly, even for me, right, I've done this and this, I think I should be rewarded by getting this. They're the most cringe-worthy conversations I think you can have, but you're going to have to do them. So you're going to have to just get stuck into it and do it. For me, as I mentioned, I've gotten to a point in football where I now have a bit of a track record like behind me, where I feel like if I was to go and reach out and work with a football club, I would say, well, look at this, I've done this. Like, I'm not doing that work for free. So I think it's about backing yourself up, and something that, if any young players are listening, moving forward, you will have to do, and like interviews, CVs, cover letters, you know, dear whoever, I am the best person ever at doing this, blah, 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 blah. You're going to have to sell yourself. So I would start working on stuff like that just now, because if you are working in sport, you're going to have to be able to differentiate yourself from others, which in a very over, you know, populated field, I would say.
Yeah, sell yourself is in any aspect of life, in any career, any part of your journey. Yeah, you've got to sell yourself. You know, that's what an interview is, isn't it? Essentially, so it's a CV. You know, you're selling yourself in a written form, then you've got to sell yourself in person. You've got to back it up, haven't you? So it's, yeah, sell yourself is a very good piece of advice. A couple of questions left. Penultimate one, kind of, you've mentioned it a little bit in the previous responses that you've said, and we kind of like to be a little bit ahead of the curve here on the podcast, is what's the next big thing in sports psychology? Is there anything kind of current, up and coming trends that you see, kind of whether it's in tennis, football or sport in general? Or is it just a case of still plowing along, fighting the good fight and trying to establish that kind of parity and that equal recognition within, you know, alongside other disciplines from a sports science perspective?
Yeah, I think there's some buzzwords that come to mind just when you ask the question. Well-being certainly is one of those at the moment. So instead of just banding the word around, can we actually provide more education around what it is and how we can have control over it? I think holistic is another one. A lot of people are saying, oh yeah, you know, we consider the player and the athlete, but do you though? Like, what is it that you're doing for each part of that individual's identity, and can you evidence that? I think could be a bit more clarity on it. And another is resilience. I feel like it's a big one that's came out over the last few years. I mean, formerly maybe mental toughness was used, mental resilience has become kind of came more into the frame. Do individuals understand what that is? Because resilience isn't suffering. It's not enduring. It's not just doing stuff, even though it's making you feel horrendous. It's overcoming challenges and setbacks. And that doesn't mean alone. It's about using others to support you through that as well. So I think there could be a bit more clarity on that, like from sports clubs and stuff, because I feel like, you know, especially in academy football where it's so competitive, you feel like you have to do everything, and if you don't do it, then it's going to affect your chances. And the problem there lies with the people who are in the positions of power in that situation, where they need to understand that that should not be the case. If it's going to damage you like mentally, then you shouldn't have to do that thing. And I think it's about maybe understanding that a little bit better. So again, like we mentioned earlier, breaking the stigma down through education of what sports psychology is, how it can help, and also how it can be embedded into clubs and organizations. I think that goes on the part of the, you know, from our side, the sports psychology side of things. Can we be doing more on that to help individuals learn about how we can support them? Because there can be a bit of naivety, especially if you've been studying sports psychology for so long. Oh, like, how does this person not know like what sports psychology is? Like, oh, it's so obvious. You can get caught up in your own bubble. So I think we could be doing more about promoting it and promoting education around it in a more effective way. And probably lastly, I would like to see more advocates for sports psychology from like an elite sports person type of angle. I understand that can be a bit of an issue for you know, confidentiality purposes, and if athletes don't want to disclose that they're working with a sports psychologist, then that's completely okay. But you know, I've heard from the likes of Rory McIlroy, he's been supported by a sports psychologist at the Open and stuff like that in the past, and really advocated for the ways that have supported him. And I think for young golfers or young athletes, when they go, all right, he's working with a sports psychologist and it's helping his performance and it's helping him feel better. All right, is that kind of the angle that a sports psychologist works on, rather than just, oh, a sports psychologist, you're working with him, there must be something wrong with you. So I would like that, because you know, we know how much young athletes look up to you know, role models in sport. So if they're saying something, it can be taken as gospel. So I'd like to hear a little bit more from them on sports psychology as well.
Good. And final question, we give that to you to leave a lasting impression. So is there a piece of advice that you wish to give our listeners on the episode around well-being, psychology, something else, you know, piece of advice for life, career related, academy football, sport in general? How do you want to leave the episode?
I think that you're more than just a footballer, you're more than just an athlete is probably a common thing that I've mentioned throughout. So I'll just chuck that in here again at the end. And I think also, you need to maybe redefine what a successful career in football is, because I've got mates, I've worked with people who have had a successful career in football, but they maybe play twice a week and at the weekend playing for like Forfar, who maybe play in League One in Scotland. For me, that's like amazing. That's so successful. And everyone around me looks up to like people with that, because they think, oh my God, like he's played at a good level, a better level than what, you know, any of us sort of have. So I understand that you're in an academy setup, you're working with so many other guys who are on your level or similar level, and some of them might go on to play at a higher level than you. But for me, a successful career in football is still being involved in the sport. And if it's about making money through it, then you can still do that through the lower leagues. But on the same note, that you should have a plan B for that, because a successful career in football often looks like someone who has another job, which is totally fine. So take time to explore what it really is that you want to do with your life, whether that's in sport or out of it. Do some research into it. Don't just go into it gung-ho and just go, oh, well, you know, I played sport, I may as well just apply to a sport coaching degree, because there might be a point where you decide that you don't like that. So take some time to explore other parts of your identity and, you know, what's really important to me, what do I want to learn more about, what skills can I use from my career in football that are going to help me in my career as well. And I think lastly, just on so the sports psychology kind of side of it, if you're unsure about what sports psychology is or how a sports psychologist can help you, don't turn your back on that support that might be around you. engage in it, try and learn something from it. And if you were ever to wanted to know anything else about it, then, you know, I'm happy for anyone to contact me on that, because I think it's something that can, you know, I think it's something that's really interesting and that players could really learn a lot about and benefit from really moving forward.
Yeah, that's a great way to end it. And obviously we'll be sure to put the details of your podcast in the bio of this episode, as well as the program, the Wellbeing Academy that you run, and your Instagram page as well, so any of our listeners can reach out to you independently and directly just to find out more, even to kind of follow on the conversation that we've just been having over the last 60 or so minutes. And yeah, I want to thank you for your time this morning. It's been great to chat with you, Brad. It's been informative for me, and I think that's the thing. You think you know certain things, or you have a perception of what psychology is or how best to support somebody from a well-being, but everybody's individual. And the biggest thing I'm going to take away is, you know, don't do things alone. I think, you know, COVID probably and lockdown impacted on that a little bit, but, you know, those days are hopefully long gone and behind us, and there's support network out there in many different ways, shape and forms for academy players and parents and staff who listen to the podcast to be able to, you know, support that person behind the player. So thank you for your time. Thank you on behalf of our listeners. It's been great to chat with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, mate. I hope that some of that information was useful for our listeners.
What an individual, and what an episode that was. Brad gave us an immense amount of information to take in, and here's just three that I'd like to recap. Stop comparing yourself. We're all guilty of it. We all do it. But that's where the well-being piece really starts to fall down. Whether it's social media, a teammate, your next door neighbour, a friend, a foe, doesn't matter. Stop comparing yourself to others. You are you. Continue being you and do what is right for you. You picked up so many skills along your journey, and Brad gave you just a few examples of what they would look like in academy football. We often forget, whether it's 8 weeks, a season, or 10, or somewhere in between, you've picked up so many skills, so many attributes, so many qualities, so many abilities during your academy journey, all which will contribute to your own well-being. And remember, don't do it alone. That's what we're here for, that's what your coach is there for, and that's what every single member of academy staff is there for. Don't forget your parents, don't forget your teammates, don't forget your friends. You don't have to do it alone. If your well-being isn't where it needs to be, where you feel it should be, or you're just having a bad day, there are people out there you can connect with. You can find out more about today's guest on their website. You can check out their social media platforms for more of what we discussed today, all of which you will find in the bio of this episode. Reach out and continue the conversation towards taking ownership of your personal development and unlocking your potential on and off the pitch. As always, if you haven't already, make sure you hit the follow button on our podcast, as well as follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and connect with us via LinkedIn to provide us with your feedback on this episode and give us suggestions for ones in the future. As always, be sure to share this episode with your teammates, friends, parents, coaches, and whoever else you feel would benefit from listening to this. Until next time, when we bring you yet another interview from the locker.